this week's 51%, a university creates an endowment chair for a feminist icon. We hear about women of color becoming doulas.
When you research doulas or like anything you find online, the most mainstream things are white, middle-class women.
Nurses help refugees navigate the healthcare system. Plus, we catch a glimpse of courtship in Kazakhstan. I'm Allison Dunn, and this is 51%. Rutgers University in New Jersey is doing something officials there say is the first endeavor of its kind, creating an endowment chair in the name of a living feminist icon, Gloria Steinem. 51%'s Patrick Garrett spoke with Allison Bernstein, the director for the Institute of Women's Leadership and professor of history at Rutgers.
Let me just start off by asking you how the idea for the endowment chair position came up.
Well, without trying to sound immodest, it was an idea that I had once I realized that Gloria Steinem, at age 80, was going to be the winner of a Presidential Medal of Freedom in 2013. And I went to a reception honoring her and realized that there was never a endowed chair of a living person who was a real icon in terms of gender equity and feminism. And luckily, Rutgers had one of the strongest programs in women and gender studies, in women's history, and a school of journalism and communication. The school is called the School of Communication and Information, but the program inside that school was journalism and media studies. So I came back from that reception and talked to our board of directors at the IWL, the Institute for Women's Leadership. And they were very enthusiastic. I think they were a little challenged by the idea of raising money for an endowed chair. Rutgers does not have any endowed chairs, either in the School of Communication or in the Department of Women and Gender Studies. But they thought Gloria had earned that really extraordinary presidential medal and that Rutgers could do something around the subject of media, culture, and feminism. So we got started on it really in the spring of 2014 and got two very important early grants from the Ford Foundation and the Knight Foundation. And we launched officially in September of 2014. And here we are just about, a year and a half later, passing the 2,100,000 mark.
Now, you said you expect to have the position filled when you hit the $3 million endowment mark, correct?
Right. That's correct. In fact, the total endowment is $3 million, but we also have been fundraising for a program fund which would sponsor all kinds of activities related to media and culture and feminist studies. And we've made it halfway to the $500,000 mark for that. So, the endowment is the hardest money to raise. And I guess what I want to say is most endowed chairs are typically named for the person who is endowing it. And this is unusual in that this is an endowment campaign to name it for someone other than anyone who's given money to the endowment for the chair. And also, it's much more, I would say, bottom-up than typical top-down. We have over 250 donors already contributing to this chair.
Now, because this is the first of its kind in the sense of being an endowment chair for a living feminist icon.
Right.
Would you expect this to create a sort of precedent for more endowment chairs in similar sense for more feminist icons across the country?
There is no one quite like Gloria Steinem, I have to say that. And interestingly enough, she is not a Rutgers grad. She went to Smith, and there are several important activities at Smith in her name. But there's never been a chair that basically says, this work in media, culture, and feminist studies is so important that we need to have a permanent endowment that will secure it for future generations. The answer to your question is I hope it leads other universities and colleges to think about it. It's not easy to fundraise either for a living person or for a person who isn't him or herself very wealthy. I think there may be a grand total of a dozen endowed chairs named for women across the country, and not all of them, in fact, very few of them, are named for people who are still alive.
In comparison with other chair positions at the university, will this chair have any other responsibilities?
Well, first of all, there will be nominations, and the first and subsequent chair holders will be selected recommended to the president and to the board of governors by a committee. And we're looking for people who have made significant contributions to the way in which the media portrays both men and women in a more gender-neutral and inclusive fashion. So the first thing to say is the chair is permanent, but the people who will be appointed to the chair will rotate 3 to 5 years, give or take. The second thing to say is one of the requirements of the chair is, of course, to teach. And we're expecting, at the very least, a course every year, probably more, depending upon the person's expertise. Third, there's a whole program agenda for this chair that just goes beyond teaching Rutgers graduate students or Rutgers undergraduates. We're really interested in creating a forum or a summit in which different issues, for example, the one we are thinking of launching with is gender, media, and politics, which is, we think, highly relevant to the next year or so in American political life. So I guess the answer would be the chair will not control what other faculty members do at Rutgers, but we're expecting that whoever's named to the chair will have such a distinguished track record that we will use this to broaden the scope of the work that links media, journalism, and gender studies.
Now, I'm also aware that you have a Gloria Steinem Media Mentoring Program offered through the Institute for Women's Leadership at Rutgers.
Yes, that is part of the program agenda, not part of the chair, which is, of course, an endowment. And the Media Mentoring Program was funded in its pilot year by the Revson Foundation. And that program is pretty unique because instead of internships while students are undergraduates, the target population for this mentoring program are recent graduates, are people who have chosen to work in the field of media, but really are looking for advice, guidance, ways to, you know, advance their careers. And they do that by meeting up with and being mentored by and matched by our program, women leaders in the field of media.
What role is Gloria playing in the creation of this chair position?
Gloria is a very non-egotistical person. She's the opposite of a diva. So she's always a little nervous about something in her name. But she has played an active role in advising the steering committee, being a member of the steering committee. She's been both to the Rutgers New Brunswick and the Rutgers Newark campuses. She will be meeting with the alums in the media mentoring program. So she's very, very engaged in this, even though her current book is on the bestseller list. We've managed to figure out how to tap into Gloria's great strength as not just an icon, but as a wise person who looks forward to talking to other generations of women. There's a famous line of hers. Somebody asked her, well, who are you going to pass the torch to? And she said, I'm not passing the torch to any particular person. I'm just going to help light everybody else's torch.
That was 51%'s Patrick Garrett speaking with Allison Bernstein, director for the Institute of Women's Leadership and professor of history at Rutgers University, about the Gloria Steinem Endowed Chair in Media, Culture, and Feminist Studies. A doula is a woman who helps another woman before, during, and after childbirth. Traver Riggins says when she learned about how a doula could help, she wanted to hire one, but financially it seemed impossible. This difficulty is what led Riggins to want to become a doula herself. Leela Day reports for KALW's Cross Currents.
There you go. What do you think?
I got that pump.
You like that pom-pom?
I
like that pom-pom too.
Treva Riggins is playing with her toddler Charlie at home in Oakland. Riggins works as a server at a restaurant on the weekends, and during the week, she takes care of her daughter. She also recently became a doula.
When I became pregnant, I became really interested in natural childbirth, and through researching that, I stumbled across this word doula. I was like, what's that?
Riggins says when she learned about how a doula could help, she wanted to hire one, but financially, it seemed impossible.
The going rate for a doula was $1,500, and there was no way we could afford just an extra $1,500 on top of getting ready for a baby and just keeping a roof over our head and paying bills.
She found that for many women, having a doula was considered a luxury item. Studies have shown that having a doula present at birth can decrease the use of medications and C-sections, but most insurance companies don't cover the expense. This difficulty is what led Riggins to want to become one herself.
It almost became an obsession, becoming a doula. I was like, I need to do this. I need to do it immediately.
Riggins says becoming a doula was also about representing women of color, like her.
When you research doulas or anything you find online, the most mainstream things are white, middle-class women. I was curious more than anything, I think, to see, are there other doulas of color? Am I going to be an only when I try to do this? Where's my space in it?
In downtown Oakland, Riggins discovered Black Women Birthing Justice and the Birth Justice Project. Both programs were collaborating to offer doula training for women of color and formerly incarcerated women. Linda Jones is one of the coordinators and a doula herself. She's helped birth over 1,000 babies. Jones says there's often a surprised reaction when she mentions her job to other Black women.
They go, people pay for that? And I go, yes, they do.
Jones has been able to laugh about some of the reactions, but she also recognizes a major healthcare disparity. Black Women Birthing Justice found that Black women are rarely educated about using doulas and midwives. They're also least likely to access prenatal care and more likely to deliver by C-section and to suffer untreated postpartum depression. Jones says having the support of a doula can decrease some of these risks for Black mothers.
Having a baby without medication is all about letting your body relax and not fighting your body. And if you're in fear and if you're in pain, you're going to fight against your body.
Feeling fear and pain can make a person's body physically tighten up.
If they can relax, then labor is better because they're not fighting their uterus. Your uterus is a muscle that's trying to open up. And if you tighten it, tighten your body, you're tightening your uterus.
A major part of a doula's job is to help a laboring woman relax. And for some women of color, having a doula who looks more like them can be reassuring. But Jones says it's also about personal preference.
I'm not kind of a hippie granola kind of doula. It's just not my thing. And I tell them that. I say, if you want hippie granola, maybe you should get one of those young white girls because I don't carry a bag of stuff around with me with herbs and potions. And I just don't do that.
Newly trained doula Treva Riggins is parked in front of a shelter meeting a client who didn't want her name on the air. She's 7 months pregnant and homeless.
I do want a natural birth, mostly without medications, unless something really bad happens, but I'm sure I'll be able to do it.
Take some deep breaths.
With her daughter in the back seat, Riggins leads her client through some relaxation exercises.
You even let the rest of the day just melt away for just a couple minutes.
They've got a couple of stops to make today. To the hospital to meet the client's doctor, and then to a resource center called Homeless Prenatal Program. Before being connected with Riggins there, the client said she had never even heard of a doula.
It's just disappointing that a lot of low-income families don't know about doulas and midwives.
Next week, the two will work on a birthing plan. When the baby is born, Riggins will support her client's recovery and aid her in caring for her newborn. Riggins isn't getting paid for any of this, but for now she's okay with it.
This is not something that I can do that's sustainable, but it's something that I must do. It's not that I don't want to serve the community that can pay me. That's just not who I think needs me. You know, like, I know that there's a community of birthers who need me, especially because I'm willing to be there for them, that can't pay.
When Riggins thinks back on her labor, she remembers being surrounded by faces who didn't look like hers, and having to deal with doctors and nurses who seemed exasperated by her desire to have an unmedicated birth. Although she never had a doula by her side, she's now determined to be that support for the women who may need her most.
No! Oh, no!
Can Mommy help you? Let me help you.
For Cross Currents, I'm Leela Day.
Starting a new life is not easy for the nearly 70,000 refugees that enter the U.S. each year. They face challenges like language and cultural barriers, and for some, navigating the complexities of the healthcare system. So one program in Missouri is working with new refugees to help them become self-sufficient, one appointment at a time. Rebecca Smith for Side Effects Public Media reports from Columbia, Missouri.
Laudlin Leanna walks up to the receptionist desk at his doctor's office. He signs in, gives his name and address, and pays a small copay. $12.50. But standing just behind him, off to the side, are two nursing students from the University of Missouri, who are there to help Leanna if he needs help communicating with the receptionist or filling out forms.
We're going to guide them, and so maybe the first time we'll help them basically talk to the people in front desk.
That's Stone Chen. He and his partner, Emily Nguyen, are working with Leanna and other refugees as part of a health navigator program started by fellow nursing students 2 years ago.
As more appointments they go, we're going to let them speak to the front desk, let them call the interpreters. We'll be there to guide them, watch them.
This help can be invaluable for refugees trying to adjust to a new life. Like for Leanna, at the time of this appointment, he'd only been in the U.S. for a month.
1 month only.
He's originally from Myanmar, but for the past several years, he and his family have been living in a refugee camp because of political unrest. Now, making it to the doctor for a checkup can be especially important for refugees. According to the Federal Office of Refugee Resettlement, refugees face more health issues such as tuberculosis, diabetes, hypertension, post-traumatic stress disorder, and depression.
Refugees are a whole another level of need because they have so many more extra vulnerabilities.
That's Megan Gore, the Refugee Health Coordinator for Refugee and Immigration Services in Mid-Missouri. She says the office of 7 employees serves about 150 new refugees a year. And refugee caseworkers,
they're definitely exhausted, you know, and then they get the houses set up. They get the Social Security and food stamps and initial primary care appointment. And most of the time, yeah, they're just able to take them to the appointment and then pick them back up.
So this is where nursing students step in to fill the gap, taking refugees through the entire process of a doctor's visit. But Chen is clear. This is more than just hand-holding.
I think the best way to learn is you do it yourself. With the refugees, if we just do everything for them and every time, then they, in a way, become dependent on us. And the more work for us, it doesn't help them grow, doesn't help them survive.
So the students stand back and let the refugees do it on their own.
We're trying to promote self-sufficiency.
Megan Gore from Refugee and Immigration Services says the nursing students have helped a lot since creating the program. In 2014 alone, nursing students, volunteers, and case managers partnered to cover 130 health appointments. In fact, Gore says the program is working so well, she, along with others, are working to create a more sustainable position, a refugee health advocate.
We need to have a more advanced position where students actually go in to appointments. They keep track of case notes. They do follow-ups.
And while the nursing students are volunteering through their community health class, it goes beyond that. Emily Nguyen says it's helping her become a better nurse by making her more conscious of other people's challenges.
It's been a pretty good experience just to change my care, like as a nurse, just to realize that everyone comes from a different place and has their own barriers to deal with, like along with like language barriers and cultural barriers. Just like seeing the person as a person and not like a refugee or a race.
For Side Effects Public Media, I'm Rebecca Smith.
This story was produced by Side Effects Public Media, a reporting collaborative focused on public health. And now a female first, sports short. The first woman to work as a scout for an NFL team says the Buffalo Bills' hiring of Catherine Smith as the league's first full-time female assistant coach is a great opportunity for women. Connie Carberg recently said during an interview with the Associated Press that she was surprised and very excited when Rex Ryan promoted Smith to special teams quality control coach January 20th. The 64-year-old Carberg served as a scout for the New York Jets from 1976 to 1980. She is credited with bringing attention to then-little-known defensive end Mark Gastineau, who became one of the league's top pass rushers after being drafted by the Jets out of East Central Oklahoma State in 1979. Carberg is encouraged that doors continue to open for women in traditionally male-dominated sports. Valentine's Day is around the corner. Maybe you don't care. Maybe you're thrilled. Regardless, here's a look at courtship in another part of the world. There's a girl, a boy, a horse, and a chase. Global Guru takes you inside the world of courtship in Kazakhstan.
Welcome to The Global Guru. I'm Rachel Louise Snyder. Each week we ask one simple question, just one, about somewhere in the world. Today we're in Kazakhstan asking, will you marry me?
If he will not be able to catch her, she has a right to whip him.
Whip him?
Yes. With real leather whip.
This is Alma Kuninabayeva, professor of anthropology at Stanford. She's describing a courting ritual known as
Kazku,
which literally translates to chasing the girl. It's a game. A boy, a girl, and their horses.
She's galloping away, and he has to chase her. And then the rule is, if he will catch her within some special distance, he has a right to kiss her.
If not, out comes the whip. The game's a way for Kazakh girls to show their readiness for marriage. And she invites him to the chase, because the game is really all about the girls.
How strong they are, how beautiful they are, how skillful they are.
Kuninabayeva says it's not so foreign to us.
I can tell you, everybody who went or survived the prom, they know that situation. Who is inviting whom? Who is chasing whom?
Nomads in Kazakhstan have been playing it since the 17th century. The game is really what she calls a training camp for life.
Every winter is a test for survival. Life of nomadic women are so difficult that they have to be strong like men.
Today, girls train for years to play. They're given the best horse from their tribe. Because, Kuninabayeva says,
it's not only her victory, it's victory of her people.
And sometimes the victory even goes beyond her own community. She tells the story of two tribes. One had murdered a boy in the other.
So for a long time, these two tribes, they avoid each other and they never participated in the same gatherings.
But then, a girl invited a boy from the other tribe to play the game.
Along the way, he caught her and kissed her. On the way back, both of them, they came to her parents and she said, now you have a choice, parents. Accept him and forgive them for everything that happened, or to kill us.
Kuninabayeva says it was a powerful political statement. And eventually,
the wedding was about these two tribes reuniting.
The Global Guru is produced in association with American University's College of Arts and Sciences and WAMU 88.5 in Washington, D.C. Original theme by The Plush Interiors. I'm Rachel Louise Snyder. Thanks for listening.
And that's our show for this week. Thanks to Patrick Garrett for production assistance. Our executive producer is Dr. Alan Shartok. Our theme music is Glow in the Dark by Kevin Bartlett. This show is a national production of Northeast Public Radio. If you'd like to hear this show again, sign up for our podcast or visit the 51% archives on our website at wamc.org. And follow us on Twitter at 51% Radio. This week's show is number 1385.